Begin with prayer. Let's pray. Holy God, on a day that we are bewildered by the events of terror in Orlando, with those casualties heavy on our hearts, and as we struggle to know what it means even to be a forgiving people when such things happen, we ask that you be with us in the struggle. We ask that you speak a word to us today about what it might mean to be a forgiving people. We ask this all in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay. All right. It is great to be with you this morning. I have heard about you for a long, long time. My colleague in the dean's office, Allison Riemersma, is a member here. It's just great to be in your midst. And I've been here for meetings before, but this is my first time teaching with you. So thank you for welcoming me. I was really pleased to get Rebecca's email back earlier in the spring, and you know, here I am. And so we're going to reflect a little bit on the life of Dietrich Bonhoeffer and some of his writings on forgiveness and talk about the implications for that for us today. I don't like to talk the entire time that I teach adult ed classes, so interrupt me whenever you want. I will leave time at the end for questioning, but the questions aren't limited till the end. So if I'll pause from time to time, ask for your thoughts, and that's kind of how we'll proceed. But we have to end at 11:10, is that correct, in order to get to church on time? All right, okay. We'll do our best. Okay, so Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who's heard of him before? Okay. I think he is one of the most significant, if not the most significant, Protestant theologian of the 20th century. He did not live a long time. He didn't even see his 40th birthday. His dates, if you're interested, are 1906 to 1945. And I think what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about his life and context, and then we'll move to how he talked about forgiveness, because his life is inseparable from how he thought about Christian faith. But I think it's fair to say that he lived his words with more integrity than nearly any Christian of the last century. So when you encounter him, there's no disconnect between what he said and what he did. For most of us, we like to think that our thoughts and our intentions reveal our true and better selves. But what we see enacted in our lives are somewhat less than our best intentions and our best thoughts. Is that true for you? I don't always live the way that I talk about living, but Bonhoeffer did. And I want to talk specifically now about how he changed his mind on Christian involvement in social questions, okay, and particularly as it relates to politics, and particularly as it relates to the question of pacifism, whether or not Christians are to ever resort to force. And that gives some context for how he thinks about forgiveness, because what I'm going to talk about are what he describes as a contrast between cheap and costly forgiveness. Okay, there's cheap forgiveness, which is saying one thing, and then there's costly forgiveness, which demands something of us. Okay, but I want to begin in the early 1930s, before the rise of Nazism in Germany. And he writes about Christian ethics and Christian responsibility to the state. Bonhoeffer was a Lutheran. And in traditional Lutheranism, there was this idea of two realms, that God ordained two realms in the created world. There is the spiritual realm, which is the sphere of the church. Okay, it's governed by the gospel, and that is what proclaims salvation. Okay, so there's the church. Okay, but there is also the civil realm, the realm of politics, the realm of government. And God ordains both of these spheres to preserve order. The churchly sphere or the spiritual sphere proclaims salvation and forgiveness. The secular sphere or the governmental sphere keeps us from being at each other's throats. And all persons are subject to the civil sphere. Okay, every person on earth needs to follow the rules of the society that he or she finds him or herself in. And the civil sphere is governed by law, laws that human beings write under the guidance of God. Now, Martin Luther actually said that it's often better if the civil sphere is not governed by Christians, okay? Because I'm going to try to make a joke, but the jokes never really fly. A person who is not a regular churchgoer is not as troubled or bothered by matters of forgiveness and conscience and love, for that matter. I mean, so that the role of government is to make laws to keep things more or less orderly and civil. So do you get that? Okay, so those are two different, they sometimes seem to be in tension with one another. The churchly sphere can proclaim forgiveness and love, and the role of government is to restrain the wicked. That's basically the point. And so for Orthodox Lutherans, or hardline Orthodox Lutherans, it's not the job of the church to question the state. Okay? Both are put in place by God, and these two realms are distinct from one another, and they're to stay out of each other's business. All right? So here's what Bonhoeffer writes in 1930, before Hitler comes to power, before Nazism is a threat, really. This is what he says. Without a doubt, the church of the Reformation has no right to address the state directly in its political actions. It has neither to praise nor to question the laws of the state, but must rather affirm the state to be God's order of preservation in a godless world. Okay? This is kind of straightforward, hardline Lutheran orthodoxy. The church should not mess in the affairs of the state and vice versa. Okay? Well, something happens in 1933, and you're all aware of that, and that is the rise of Nazism. And Bonhoeffer, in response to that, begins to change his tune. Now, in 1930 and 1931, Bonhoeffer spends a year in the United States. He studies at Union Theological Seminary in New York. That year in America forces him to confront some things. He sees the violence of racism in American society. His best American friend is one of the few African American students at Union Seminary, and that experience with that student really opens his eyes to what is happening with Jews in Germany, in his homeland. So that pivotal experience is very important. He then returns to the U.S. again in 1939 after he becomes involved in some political acts of resistance at the invitation of some folks at Union Seminary. But he only stays for about 3 months, and he realizes, or he says in letters home, it was a mistake for me to flee what was going on in my homeland. I cannot share in the future of the German people if I don't take part in the sufferings of the German people right here and right now. And so he quickly goes back to Germany, and that's a decision that eventually leads to his death, because from then on out, he becomes more and more involved with acts of resistance against Nazism. But here's what Bonhoeffer does in 1933 in a radio address 2 days after Hitler rises to power. This is what he says. If the leader allows himself to be persuaded by those he leads who want to turn him into their idol, then the image of the leader will degenerate into that of the misleader. And the German word for misleader here can also be described as seducer, or it's even a euphemism for the devil. The leader who makes an idol of himself and his office makes a mockery of God. And as soon as he says those words, the plug is pulled on his radio address. So Bonhoeffer had this regular radio address, and when he says those sentences, the plug is pulled, and he's unable. It's no longer broadcast what he is saying. So two days after Hitler comes to power, notice how quickly, speech is curtailed and so on. okay, and then a couple months later, Bonhoeffer writes this about the church's role in relation to the state. First, the church can ask the state whether its actions are legitimate. It can throw the state back on its responsibilities. Okay, so one thing that the church can do in relation to the state is ask questions. Why is the government doing this? What is going on here? Is what the government is doing is just or not? Okay. Secondly, the church can aid the victims of state action. The church has an unconditional obligation to the victims of any ordering of society, even if they do not belong to the Christian community. The third possibility is not just to bandage the victims under the wheel, but to put a spoke in the wheel itself. So there's this image of when the government gets out of control, it can roll people under like a steamroller. Such action would be direct political action and is only possible when the church sees the state fail in its function of creating law and order. I'm just going to pause there for a second. What does this raise for you? What questions do you have, either about Bonhoeffer's context or what's going on at this time? All right. Does this trigger anything?
Yeah. So I find what's happening now really scary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm a church going to.
Yes.
So the fact that you raise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
What I've been thinking about.
Yes.
For months and months.
Yeah. Yeah.
Question, but it's kind of like I'm paying attention to where I'm saying it and who to I'm saying it to, not this morning, but usually,
yeah.
Because it meets a lot of resistance and it brings up fear and and at the same time, do I want to see more resistance and more, mm-hmm. more coming
right.
together and
right.
Even if the role of event going forward would not bring us there, the fact that there are some similarities should scare us enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, rhetoric is scary. The interesting thing about, Hitler never got, his party never got a majority vote in the German elections. There was never a winning a majority. But the movement began by blaming others for the predicament of the German nation. So it's not, it's so-and-so's fault. It's blaming. And of course, Jews were the chief scapegoat for why there was this, quote, decline of the German nation. And I'm going to speak specifically in a minute about how what Bonhoeffer did in relation to Jews of his time. It's alarming. I mean, the rise of hate speech. Yeah. Go ahead. Oh.
Statue of Liberty.
Okay.
Anyways, so two questions come to mind.
Yep.
One is, even though the plug was pulled on Bonhoeffer's radio address, did he continue to speak and publish, or was he, how much was he silenced?
Yeah, well, the pulling the, so the question is how, you know, after the pulling the plug of the radio address, how is Bonhoeffer able to speak out, write, so on? I mean, what happened with the radio address is the first of several actions that lead to increasing silencing of Bonhoeffer. He's allowed to speak and preach, write. Eventually, he becomes involved in a seminary that goes underground. So part of what happens in the church in Germany is mirrored in society. So there's a movement to make the church more Nazi, where eventually anyone who has Jewish ancestry is excommunicated. All pastors of the Protestant church are required to take oaths of allegiance to Hitler, okay? These kinds of things. Bonhoeffer refuses to do such, and as a result goes underground with this significant movement. But, you know, over the years, and it's basically 10 years between the time where his radio address is interrupted to the time he's arrested, and over the course of those 10 years, he is increasingly silenced. Until the end, he can't teach, preach, or write anything, really.
Okay. Yeah. Actually, you kind of answered the second question. Yeah. The second question was, even though the church had the right to question politics, was it just sort of an empty questioning, or was it a questioning with the result of government was accountable to principles? When you say that the church retained the right to ask questions, just ask questions like, what are you doing? Okay, you're doing that, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, so what does he mean by questioning? I mean, here Bonhoeffer begins pretty cautiously. It's not an immediate movement from the church has no right to question the church to full-fledged sabotage of government. It's part of what I'm trying to document is it's a slow transition. And you're gonna see the Bonhoeffer, where Bonhoeffer ends up is very different from that first quote I gave you. But let me move there. I think that's maybe a good place to go. As you know, soon after 1933, the German state enacts legislation restricting civil liberties of Jews. One of the first things that happens is the requiring of all Jews to wear the yellow star on their person. Bonhoeffer, after that law is passed, puts together a document that calls for the abolition of that law and gave it to sympathizers within the German army and in the German government, opposition parties. He helped a number of Jews flee Germany. When the deportation decree was enacted later in Germany, which removes Jews from their homes and ghettoizes them, relocates them to ghettos, and then eventually to a concentration camp, Bonhoeffer works on a secret plot which provides the safe transport of dozens of Jews to Switzerland. So he provides documents, false passports, and so on. That, you know, so German passports at that point, you know, after these laws are enacted, indicate whether or not a German citizen is Jewish or not. He provides a non-Jewish passport to these those who are fleeing. And a lot of this is aided because of Bonhoeffer was very involved in ecumenical circles in Europe and the wider Christian world. And he has these contacts in Switzerland and Scandinavia and England, and it's through these contacts that he is works these arrangements that allow for the safe passage of Jews out of the nation. He, you know, the lives of most theologians are rather boring. Bonhoeffer's is not. He in 1940 then becomes essentially a double agent. Okay, one of his cousins works for the military intelligence arm of the German army, who is a conspirator against the Hitler's regime. Bonhoeffer becomes a part of this German military intelligence unit, and it is that group that is actively seeking to topple Hitler. And so, you know, ostensibly, Bonhoeffer is working as a German intelligence agent, but is in actual fact working as a double agent. And that's what happens there is that German military intelligence unit hatches a plot and smuggles a bomb aboard Hitler's airplane in 1943, in March 1943, but the time bomb never explodes. One month later, Bonhoeffer's involvement in that plot is discovered. He is arrested and then spends the rest of his life in prisons and eventually a German concentration camp, and he dies really in the waning days of World War II. It's in April 1945 that he is executed in a concentration camp. That is the story of his life. And what happens here is that Bonhoeffer changes from a position of absolute pacifism to a conditional acceptance of violence as the absolute last resort. Okay, I want to make this contrast, and then we'll talk about it. In 1932, he writes a book that many of you may have heard of called The Cost of Discipleship. And he says this in that book: "The command, 'You shall not kill,' and the word, 'Love your enemy,' are given to us simply to obey." Okay? We can't avoid that command of Christian discipleship. Loving enemies and rejecting violence and rejecting the sword carry over into every aspect of our life. No area of our life is exempt from it. He writes later in that book, "Jesus' followers are called to peace. Jesus is their peace. Now they are not only to have peace, but they are to make peace. To do this, they must renounce violence and strife. Those things never help the cause of Christ." And of course, Bonhoeffer recognizes once we do that, once we reject violence, once we live and forgive those who take up violence, what happens is that we can experience the world's rejection. Okay? The world is a violent place. When we reject violence, what we can expect is rejection by the world. Here's what he says: "Things cannot go any other way than that the world unleashes its fury in word, violence, and defamation at these meek strangers, the Christian church." Now, he writes this, and then a couple of years later becomes involved in a plot to assassinate Hitler. Okay, it's just... And what is significant about that is that he never justifies it. Okay, he never says, okay, what I did was okay, what I did was my Christian calling. He doesn't even say it's justified as the lesser of two evils. Here's what he says about it: "When a person takes guilt upon himself and responsibility, he ascribes his guilt to himself and no one else. He answers for it. Before others, he is justified by dire necessity. Before himself, he is acquitted by his conscience. But before God, he hopes only for grace." Okay, do you see what he's saying here? I mean, he's not justifying his actions. He's not saying they are explicitly Christian. But it's as if he feels that he can do nothing else and asks for forgiveness in the process, okay? Let's just linger with that a second, okay? I mean, I think most of us most times want to justify every one of our actions, okay? Bonhoeffer does not do this with his involvement in this plot to assassinate you know, the most destructive and demonic leader of the modern age. I don't know. What do you make of that? What do you think is significant in that? He asks. He takes a part in this, and then he asks for forgiveness. That's really what is going on. This is heavy stuff, but it's relevant. I think.
Well, it must be like what many people face when they go to war.
Yeah,
you know, mm-hmm. they yeah. just have to put themselves in this realm of
yeah.
something they would never do otherwise.
Yeah. Right, right. Recognizing violence for the evil that it is. Yeah, he doesn't say violence is a Christian thing.
I'm assuming he still believed what he had said about Christianity and love your neighbor mm-hmm. and thou shalt not kill.
Yeah.
So there had to be something else going on with him mm-hmm. that was equally strong or stronger, which said, in this case, you must disobey that mm-hmm. which you believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which must have been tormenting.
I think
wonder
so.
If he ever found scriptural justification or scriptural guidance mm-hmm. for why he felt he had to kill in opposition to that which he believed so deeply mm-hmm. a few years earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I don't think he finds justification for what he does scripturally. At least none of his writings indicate as much. But he feels, the closest that he comes is he feels compelled by conscience, by his own conscience, to take part in this desperate act of resistance. And when he does so, he asks for forgiveness in the process. This is all over the course of 10 years, right? So 1933 to 1943. Yeah, 10 years is a long time. Things are getting worse and worse and worse. And then you have 2 years when he's in prison where he writes a series of letters, mainly to his to a cousin who was one of his seminarians at this underground seminary. And those letters reveal a lot, but he never resorts to the language of self-justification. Never. And that's significant, I think. But he's constant, you know, he names himself as a sinner and asks for forgiveness over and over again. Okay, what else?
What I am reminded of is what I understand was one of Richard Niebuhr's reflections on the matter of making a choice like that.
Mm-hmm.
And my understanding is that he said, if you find it necessary to sin, sin boldly. And I think...
Yeah.
Any kind of justification, any kind of reference to circumstances leaves an opening for a habitual or
mm-hmm.
repeated
yeah.
instance of that behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And that as a matter of conscience, the only way to take that action and to still preserve the commandment, thou shalt not kill,
mm-hmm.
and Christ is an agent of mm-hmm. peace, mm-hmm. is to take that action as a sin, asking for God's grace
mm-hmm.
and God's forgiveness, because
yeah.
that completely takes it out of the realm of being a model for anyone else to act or setting a precedent.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think most of what you're saying is pretty true to the life and witness of Bonhoeffer. And it's actually Luther, I think, was the one who said, if you must sin, sin boldly. Maybe Niebuhr took that up. But in a way, that's kind of a freeing thought. I mean, I you know, please don't, you know... You know, I'm just thinking, the one thing that you all remember this is go out there and sin boldly. that's not what I'm saying. I mean, it's just, it's an acceptance of our predicament, that we rely on God's grace for our very life. You know, that's what that sin boldly means. It's not just go out there and do whatever you will. It's just recognize that you're limited. Recognize that you don't have God's knowledge and God's blessing in every, you know, movement of your life. I mean, and I think Bonhoeffer was a truly free human being because he recognized his own limitations and his own sinfulness. We've got about 10 more minutes, and I want to speak specific. He makes this difference between cheap forgiveness and costly forgiveness. I just want to reflect as we close our time on some of these wonderful sentences. He says, "Cheap grace is the enemy of our church. Cheap grace means cut-rate forgiveness, cut-rate comfort. Grace as the church's inexhaustible pantry from which it is doled out by careless hands without hesitation or limits. It means forgiveness of sins is a general truth. It means God's love is merely a Christian idea of God. Cheap grace means justification of sin, but not of the sinner. Because grace alone does everything, everything can stay in the same old ways. Cheap grace is that grace which we bestow on ourselves." Here's a kicker. "Cheap grace is preaching forgiveness without repentance." You see what's going on here? It is baptism without the discipline of the church. It is the Lord's Supper without confession of sin. Grace without discipleship, without the cross, without the incarnate living Jesus Christ. So Bonhoeffer is writing these sentences in the midst of a time. He's writing these words in 1934, 1935. And the church is proclaiming forgiveness, 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 at a time when it's doing nothing in the face of the evils of its time. Okay, so that's what's, you know, that's something that I want you to remember. Okay, what does it mean to proclaim forgiveness when we are faced by things that are not especially forgiving or graceful? And in the end, what this means for Bonhoeffer is that costly grace or costly forgiveness is not just simply a call to go out there and do something, but to acknowledge that we are already a part of what Christ is doing in the world. Okay? Jesus Christ is the one who forgives. Jesus Christ is the one who gives grace. And when we live in light of that, we become a forgiving people because we are made anew by Jesus Christ. And then I want to read this, what he writes from prison. He talks about the need for the church to convert to the neighbor, to convert to the world. So our conversion is not just a conversion to God or a conversion to the Christian faith. It's a conversion to others. Here's what he says. "It is not the religious act that makes the Christian, but participation in the suffering of God in the secular life. That is what conversion is. Not in the first place thinking about our own needs or problems or sins or fears, but allowing ourselves to be caught up into the way of Jesus Christ." So forgiveness in the end for Bonhoeffer isn't just saying something. Okay, forgiveness isn't just saying you are forgiven. Forgiveness isn't just doing something, something in response to the evils of our time, but being a new person in Christ, and that means to be converted to others and to the world. Bonhoeffer describes in these letters from prison Jesus Christ as the man for others, and that we are to be for others. And that's what it means to be a forgiving people, to be oriented and thrown out of the sanctuary of the church into the world, living examples of forgiveness and reconciliation in our life. Okay. We've got some time. I've got about 5 minutes or so to digest and unpack some of this. It's say that again.
Very Gandhian.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting comparison. Is this a lot like Gandhi? And I think there are some marked similarities. I'm not aware. Bonhoeffer, in the late 20s, or is it early 30s, he makes plans to visit India, and he wants to meet with Gandhi. But because of circumstances, he is unable to do that trip. But he is, at the very least, aware of what's going on in India and wants to meet and tried at one point to meet with Gandhi.
A thought occurs to me that he was sort of like choosing between the sin of action and the sin of inaction.
Oh, that's I like how you put that. Yeah,
yeah, and he... Right. Basically, is leaving it up to God to decide, you know, which is the worse or evil.
Mm-hmm. Right, you know, right.
And begging grace that he made the right choice.
I think there's a lot to how you've put that. I mean, he's faced with a choice between sin of action and sin of inaction, and chooses the former. I think that's fair to say in this context. I mean, it's remarkable to me that he never tries to, I mean, I've said this before, but that he never tries to justify. I mean, most of us in all of our actions try to justify what we've done. And in this, which is arguably the most significant action of his life, he doesn't resort to that kind of gymnastics. He just refuses to engage in that.
For months now, I have thought about, and some people in here will remember it, an incredible quote from the movie Broadcast News.
Okay. Yeah, it's been a long time since I've seen it. Yeah.
And in the movie, if I may read, this is said. They're talking about the devil, and they're talking about what will the devil be. He will be attractive. He'll be nice and helpful. He'll get a job where he influences a great God-fearing nation. He'll never do an evil thing. He'll never deliberately hurt a living thing. He will just bit by little bit lower our standards where they are important. Just a tiny little bit. Just coax along flash over substance. Just a tiny little bit. And he'll talk about all of us really being salesmen. And he'll get all the great women.
Wow. As the microphone's moving across the room, let me just say this, too. The part of what is happening in the church's life in Germany at this point in history in Germany is that fewer people are going to church. So in a way, Western Europe is about 100 years ahead of the U.S. in terms of some of these social trends. So, like, you know, in the 19th century, the church was kind of the center of a lot of village life and so on. By the 1930s, you have fewer and fewer people going to church. And so the church is concerned about its own survival, you know, longing for the days when we had more people in the pews. And the church becomes more and more kind of focused on itself, concerned with matters of personal salvation and its own survival, and less attention to the wider world. And Bonhoeffer
says that's a disastrous move. Okay, the church lives in service of the world, and we don't need to worry. God has always got the church in God's hands, and you know, panic about the church's survival is counterproductive. Yeah, go ahead.
I just want to make sure. I think I'm understanding that there's not a hierarchy. There's not a radical. Bonhoeffer didn't perceive that this was a radical evil, or that it was that what the action that he took was justified because this was such a radical evil. That it was what he needed. He felt that it was wrong, regardless, and then he sort of saw it radical grace. Is that
yes,
right?
I think that's fair to say. Yes, yes. I mean that
there's not some hierarchy that made it okay of badness.
Well, I think when confronted with the monumental nature of the systemic evil of a regime, I mean that factored into his conscience, certainly. Yeah, I mean, but not into his own justification of what he did. Right.
He didn't feel the need. He didn't think,
right.
Well, this is okay because
yeah.
He was systemically horrified.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I had a question a little bit about his early life because coincidentally, I've been reviewing a little bit about German history that I don't know very much about. But one of the things that struck me is that Nazism didn't introduce the first programs against Jews. They were introduced hundreds of years before.
Right.
They used to have to wear yellow armbands. And so the anti-Semitism and, you know, they used to have witch hunts and programs against Jews every time the economy turned down. So his initial beliefs seem almost naive.
Yeah.
That he was for years sort of ignoring this underlying evil because it wasn't quite so in his face.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I don't know what his experience was with it. Was he?
Well, his early life is actually remarkably sheltered. I mean, Bonhoeffer comes from a prominent Berlin family, wealthy, a lot of privilege. They were inherently conservative. You know, just the traditional German traditionalists guarding the old German ways. A lot of that German nobility saw the Hitler thing as kind of the laughable embarrassment, you know, on, you know, that is not taken seriously. So, Bonhoeffer doesn't have a lot of engagement with Jews in his childhood. He meets some at the university and has some, form some friendships, but he's not, you know, his family is far from radical. I mean, they're very traditional in terms of their outlook and quite conservative in their basic political orientation. But you're right. I mean, the history of anti-Semitism in Europe has deep roots, and in many ways are connected to some of the Protestant Reformation, but that's another story. I mean, Luther's writings are particularly notorious on this matter. If you go to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., you know, the opening room, there are all these quotes, anti-Semitic quotes from various points in history, and one of the most alarming is from Martin Luther. It's really... So that's deep in the water that people drank from. Yeah, you know, again, it's blaming the other. Yeah, that's. Are we out of time? It's.
I don't know.
Oh, you.
Okay. What do you consider the best biography of Bonhoeffer?
Well. The most authoritative and the best is over 1,000 pages. And it's simply called Dietrich. It's written by Eberhard Bethge, B-E-T-H-G-E. But there's a great biography that's about 120 pages. And it's by Elizabeth Raum, R-A-U-M. And that gets, you know, that gets the major events in a more accessible way. The, you know, the 1,000-page one is, it's exhaustive. And if you've got time, read it. But I really recommend the one by Elizabeth Raum. And I think it's, I can't remember the title, but her name is R-A-U-M. It's a really great, accessible summer read. But if you want the other one, go, by all means, go out. And it's written by this student of Bonhoeffer's who studied in this underground seminary that he led.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I think we're out of time.